Welcome to The Layers of Discrimination, a presentation about the levels of oppression endured by women who wear the hijab in the Canadian workplace. The thought of going to work might tempt some of us to hit the snooze button a few times in the morning. If you know that you're going to spend 8 hours dealing with pushy customers or a boss that won't get off your back, you'll do anything to put off starting your day, even if it's just for 5 minutes. But if you think that the usual stress of a job is bad, how'd you feel if you also had to spend the workday dealing with racism and harassment? This is what some women wearing the hijab in Canada are dealing with, day in and day out.
Though what is sometimes frustrating in the non-Muslim community is because, again, you'll be asked to represent everyone else, which means also you're asked sort of to be guilty for what everyone else in the Muslim community does. Muslim women are often more visible than Muslim men. You'll get that thrown on you a lot more. So if someone's really upset about, like, some article they just read in the newspaper about, you know, Muslims trying to take over the world or something, like, they will just start flipping out on you, like, on a bus or at a bus stop or at a conference or at lunch at work in a meeting. Like, I mean, people will just start flipping out on you and asking you, like, well, why did this bombing happen in Egypt? Or why did this bombing happen in Bali? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I come from Ottawa. Like, I have no idea why that happened, you know. But you'll still be assumed, you know, you'll be held accountable. And I think probably Muslim women get that a lot more than Muslim men, because Muslim men, unless they're praying 5 times a day in front of everyone, like, they can fit in, because a lot of different guys have beards, if they even wear a beard. And if they're not wearing something that visibly shows they're Muslim, like, they can just fit in. Whereas Muslim women, if they're wearing hijab, can't. People know that you are that, and so people will hold people who have bone to pick with the Muslim community will hold you accountable. So that, and sometimes that can result in violence. I know so many Muslim women who have, like, at least one story of people actually, like, spitting at them or throwing things at them. Like, I had someone throw rotten eggs at me from a moving car, you know, and then shouting, like, go home, like, you know, because we're visible.
I'm Emel El-Masri, and in the next hour, we're going to be looking at discrimination against women who wear the hijab in the Canadian workplace. Shelby Daigle, who you just heard speaking, is a 26-year-old community worker who lives in Ottawa. She has been wearing the hijab for 5 years and will be telling us about some of her past experiences at jobs.
Outside the non-Muslim community, sometimes it's just basic annoyances. Like, people just say or saying things to you, like, in the West, you don't have to wear that because you're not oppressed and no one's going to make you wear it. You have people say that to you in your workplace or on the bus. But I'm a Black person, so I'm used to people saying really stupid things to me. So I don't really get affected by that, like, to the point where I'm going to get really upset by it. I mean, people are ignorant and, you know, they should know better. Like, I do get upset with my friends do get turned down from retail jobs because they wear hijab, because that's affecting their lives and affecting their livelihood, and that's just not fair. But it comes to just people basically being ignorant. Like, I don't really care, because that's how people are, really.
Now Shelby will be telling us an anecdote about a coworker who likened the hijab to a swastika.
At one point, I was working retail. I was working at a comic book shop, and I had been hired before I started wearing hijab. I remember when I started wearing hijab, like, it was kind of weird, because even just in the nature of the work, like, it was really strange to have this woman wearing hijab, because, like, I was in charge of, like, the Japanese animation section, and, like, one of the main money earners of that section was, like, actually animated pornography. So I myself just felt really, really awkward doing that job. And also, like, we were next door to, like, a Muslim Dawa center. So just because, like, sometimes people would, like, Muslims who were going to the Dawa center would walk by the store, and then they'd see me inside, and then they'd come in and they'd actually want to make wudu in our bathroom, because, like, the Dawa center's bathroom would be, like, all filled or something. And, like, there's just a lot of funny incidents in terms of that, because, like, I couldn't let them in, and then also it was just awkward. And I remember my boss started asking me about this, like, why are all these people coming in? And I'd be like, well, because they see me and then they think they could use the bathroom. But I remember one time I was talking with one of my coworkers about stories I was hearing about, like, how people were having problems, like people who were wearing hijab were having problems in their workplace. And I remember he just made this really strange connection that really freaked me out, because he's like, well, if I had like a swastika tattooed on my forehead, I'm sure they'd fire me from Starbucks. And I was like, well, I don't think the hijab is the same as a swastika tattooed on your forehead. And I think it's really scary that you'd make that connection. But I think in the minds of a lot of non-Muslims, you know, unfortunately, like the hijab could be seen as the same as like a swastika. Like it could be seen as a symbol of hatred because of this issue of terrorism, this issue of like sort of Islamic imperialism, and the fact there is in the Muslim community, there are some people who are frankly hate mongers. And so the whole religion can get painted with that brush. In some people's minds, your hijab could be made equivalent to a swastika. And so that's why an employer might not want to hire someone who wears a hijab, because they'd be worried that people wouldn't want to approach them for help. And that's just really unfortunate.
Terrifying by the millions, and though people have died on every side, only one whole people is occupied. Terrified. Every minute, every hour of every day, it doesn't go away. You can't eat, sleep, or pray without armored bulldozers. Yeah, wherever you go, you know you're under control. That's the worst terrorism that I know.
I asked Shelby how these employment barriers against women who wear the hijab translate into their quality of life.
And people can say it's ignorance, but I think in the case of retail, where it's about men to make money, the strange thing is that like your employer could be a really open-minded person. They could still just want to make money, though, and so they're not going to hire you because they're worried about not making money. It really depends. You'll find it really depends on the line of work. Like if it's, say, a bookstore, like I've seen, like for example, Chapters. I've seen a lot of women who wear hijab working at Chapters, but it's Chapters. So like there's an assumption, I think, that probably the manager of Chapters makes that like people who buy books are going to be open-minded enough to accept the fact that they can get help from a woman who wears a hijab. Whereas if it's a sports store, a clothing store, like they might not, just because, you know, they don't really make assumptions about how open-minded their customers are. So it's just sort of interesting in terms of just the nature of retail and how you have to be approachable. You have to be seen as approachable. And a woman wearing hijab could be seen as not approachable because of all the sort of stereotypes of women who wear hijab, like in the Western world. Like she might not be seen as an approachable salesperson, so she couldn't be hired for retail.
I asked Shelby how these employment barriers against women who wear the hijab translate into their quality of life.
I think that's really unfortunate because many... You know, the reality of the Muslim community, at least in Ottawa, is that there's a lot of people who don't have a lot of money because there's a lot of, like, the Muslims of Ottawa are refugees. And so retail is a way of them, say, making money to support family or making money to go to school. So they need jobs. And so it's really unfortunate if they can't get jobs because of this kind of discrimination.
Even though Canada has had 8 consecutive years of budget surpluses, poverty is increasing, and the people it is hurting the worst are women and children. According to the Canadian Research Institute for the Advancement of Women, 1 in 7 Canadian women are now living in poverty. That's 2.4 million women. And among those groups most severely affected, racialized and immigrant women are disproportionately represented. In the case of Muslim women in Canada, who are mostly visible minorities and immigrants, the unemployment rate is 16.5%, which is more than double the unemployment rate of all Canadian women. When Muslim women are hired, they are concentrated in low-paying jobs, like retail or sales and service. On top of this, some Muslim women who elect to wear the hijab are reporting that they are insulted or harassed at work because of their headscarf. To find out more about what women who wear the hijab are experiencing in the workplace and how this is affecting their livelihood, I spoke to Dawood Hamdani, an advisor for Stats Canada who conducted a study about Muslim women's experience of discrimination that was published in 2005. The study is called Triple Jeopardy and was done for the Canadian Council of Muslim Women.
We found, one, that the unemployment rate among Muslim women was the highest of the 24 faith groups of which we had the statistics from government agencies. Unemployment rate among them was higher when compared to even those ethnic groups whose followers are primarily from Asian, African, and Middle Eastern countries. Second, that even after eliminating extraneous factors, we found that the average salary of a Muslim woman was about 10% less than the average salary of a Canadian female worker.
If the unemployment rate of Muslim women is higher than any other religion, even ones of comparable ethnic demographics, does that necessarily mean that discrimination is taking place? Even if the average salary of a Muslim woman is 10% less than the average Canadian woman, that's not clear-cut proof that Muslim women are being treated unfairly, even if Muslim women are significantly more educated. I asked Dawood Hamdani to comment on this and about the relationship between Muslim women's performance and their merit.
You know, what is merit? Is it simply the education that you have? Or other people argue that does merit include your knowledge of many languages so you can serve the clientele better? And in fact, this was put very well by the former chair of the Public Service Commission of Canada. I think writing earlier in a newspaper, he wrote that he had concerns about members of a dominant society using merit. And he went on to ask, well, who defines merit anyway? And without continually questioning, merit simply becomes a tool in the hands of the dominant society to ensure that those, and these are his words, who don't look like us, talk like us, never to allow people of different races or religions into the workplace. All these factors come into play in explaining wage differentials. Now, how much of it is because of discrimination and how much because of other factors, one doesn't really know.
Though a lot of factors can come into play when explaining wage differentials, it is hard to determine how much of it is caused by discrimination and how much of it is caused by other factors. The role that merit plays in determining the salaries of Muslim women becomes especially interesting when you consider that Muslim women are highly educated. In the findings of the 2001 Census of Canada, 34% of Muslim women in Canada have university degrees, while the national average for women with university degrees is 20%. Twice as many Muslim women hold master's and doctoral degrees as all women in the country. And yet, Muslim women are suffering from high rates of unemployment. And when Muslim women do get hired, there's a general trend of them being ghettoized in jobs for which they are overly qualified. To read more about Muslim women's experience of discrimination, you can find the study, Triple Jeopardy, on the website of the Canadian Council for Muslim Women at www.ccmw.com. Earlier this year, the Canadian Council for Muslim Women, or the CCMW, held focus groups across the country to follow up on the Triple Jeopardy study. I talked to Nuzhat Jaffrey, who is a diversity consultant and a national board member of the CCMW, about the findings of these focus groups, and also the difficulties of documenting discrimination against Muslim women who wear the hijab.
The topic of discrimination against women who wear the hijab is very under research. There isn't a lot of empirical research or data. In fact, what we need is a broader study, one that looks at women wearing hijab, or Muslim women in general, more broadly and in all occupations, not just in the retail or sales and service or manufacturing sector. One of our observations in Canadian Council of Muslim Women, CCMW, has done quite a lot of research in this area on our own. Again, our research is either based on existing data on discrimination in the workplace and employment data. And then we did follow-up focus groups with women across the country. And, you know, again, it's anecdotal. There hasn't been a lot of in-depth research. We did use an online survey, and we also conducted the questionnaire or used a survey questionnaire in writing, and women did respond to it. And in our conversations with the women, it is apparent that women who wear the hijab do experience discrimination more readily. And it doesn't really matter whether it's in the workplace or whether it's in shopping or even walking in the street. The incidence of assault or just basic disrespect to women wearing the hijab is more common than for women who do not wear the hijab.
I later asked Nuzhat Jaffrey how many women were involved in the focus groups.
I would say across the country, almost 100. Like, it's not a large number, but almost 100 women part in these focus groups. There were, we went to every large center in the country, with the exception of Vancouver. We couldn't hold a session there for logistical reasons. But, you know, we went to Montreal, we went to Ottawa, Halifax, and Toronto. We had meetings in Calgary. So I think we did get a good cross-section of women across the country. And like I said, it doesn't matter whether it's one woman telling us or 100 women telling us. It is unacceptable to hear even one story. And of course, it's not a fabrication. It really happened to the person. And it's not always easy to tell the story, but the women did tell us directly that they have experienced it.
Nuzhat Jaffrey told me later that her biggest concern is not that women who wear the hijab are facing higher unemployment, but when they do get hired, they are not getting promoted and are stuck in dead-end jobs.
The most interesting aspect of what we found in the first study, and again what we continue to find, is that because there are so many women wearing hijab in the, let's say, the retail sector, you see them, you know, as cashiers or tellers in the bank, or you see them basically quite visible. And people think, well, I guess there's no discrimination because, you know, look at how many women wearing hijab are actually working in the workplace. Our concern is that they actually, that's about all they can do. They can work in factories, they can work on the front lines in the retail sector or the sales and service sector, and that's about all. I find that their advancement is hindered. The women in more senior level positions and women who are professionals, unless they own their own businesses, and even that could be difficult, they will experience discrimination if they wear the hijab, because I have heard firsthand from employers saying that they cannot put a woman in a hijab in a client-facing role. So, for instance, if you have a sales presentation or a marketing presentation, it's very, very unlikely that you're actually going to see a woman wearing the hijab making that presentation. Similarly, when you have positions that are, let's say, in the computer science field, I've heard firsthand people say, well, you know, a woman in hijab is very good on the development side as long as she's in the back room doing the development, but they would not put her in front of a client. So that's real. That is happening. I've heard it both from an employer as well as from the woman herself, that these kinds of things go on. The women did tell us directly that they have experienced it.
Nuzhat Jaffrey pointed out that it's not just getting the jobs that's a problem, but being able to advance once you are in the job. For example, Women will get hired for jobs in the sales or manufacturing sector, but they will be confined to backroom work that is low-paying and not have a lot of opportunities to advance, effectively creating what is called a sticky floor of employment, meaning that women will start at the bottom and stay at the bottom.
Yeah, I think that's the area that we really need to now focus on, because participating in the labor market in low-paying jobs, perhaps that's something that people need to do, or the women need to do out of necessity, because often you have to have two incomes in a family and you need the money, and you basically get whatever job, you know, you can possibly get to make ends meet. But for the future, and for particularly young women who are graduating as professionals who want to practice their professions, and even women who come here who are highly qualified, who are professionals, for them to continue to be successful in the workplace and continue to advance in their careers, we know for a fact that there is a barrier for them, because, as I mentioned previously, they will not advance to senior level positions, because in Canadian society in general, particularly, I would say, in the corporate sector more than perhaps the public sector, the issue of who gets promoted, regardless of whether you're a Muslim or not, women are still behind in the corporate sector in senior level positions, in senior management positions. Study after study tells you that our progress in that area is slow. Some sectors are better than others, but that continues to be the case. So if women are behind anyway, you can be sure that Muslim women wearing the hijab will be further behind than other women. And that should be of concern to Muslims in particular, because we will continue to experience underemployment and lower rates of employment if that situation is not addressed.
Women who wear the hijab are having difficulty getting into senior management positions or getting into jobs where there are a lot of opportunities to move up. And like you heard Nusrat Jaffe and Dawood Hamdani say earlier, this is reflected in how much money they earn, not only compared to the Canadian population as a whole, but to other Canadian women. At the same time, women in general have always had trouble with a glass ceiling, meaning that they could not get promoted past a certain level. I spoke with Professor Elaine Weiner in her office at McGill University about the results of the Statistics Canada 2005 Women in Canada report. She's a professor of sociology and specializes in the area of women and work. We talked about why the situation is so much worse for women who are not from the dominant group, like women who wear the hijab, and the implications of this for wider society.
Well, in terms of unemployment, and if we're looking across the board, including all age groups, from age 15 to 64, men and women are not faring that differently. Overall, we have, as of 2004, 6.8% of women and 7.5% of men unemployed.
That's not that bad.
No, I mean, the differences between men and women in terms of unemployment, we're not seeing a huge gap there. In the types of jobs that they're getting, we're seeing big differences. If we look, for example, at senior management jobs, women, as a percentage of all of that senior management, they make up 22.1%. In effect, one of five senior managers is a female. If we look at other types of management, middle management, lower level management, we see 37.7% women. Again, about one in three. We certainly don't have parity here. If we look at it, sort of the professions as a whole, if we look at what has traditionally been male-dominated, things like the natural sciences, engineering, and mathematics, in that arena we have 21.2% women. Again, about one in five women entering a profession along those lines.
And aren't these the higher-paying jobs?
These are the higher-paying jobs, absolutely. If we look at something like social sciences and religion, this is a place where women are actually heavily concentrated. There's 71.6% women. If we look at something like teaching, there's 64.6% women. And if we look at something like nursing, and including therapy and other health-related types of jobs, 87.2% are women. These are very female-dominated. But again, if we're looking at the really top jobs and the jobs that pay really well, again, going back to things like management, those are male thresholds or male domains.
And management jobs are the jobs that you can keep ascending in, whereas jobs that are the clerical jobs are the sticky floor jobs that you were talking about earlier.
Absolutely. To have even gotten into a position of management in the first place and then to continue moving on from there, you probably were generally taken into a job that had a job ladder, that had possibilities for promotion. If you're a woman and you end up in clerical administrative work, of which 74.9% of those in clerical work are women, oftentimes that's a dead-end street. That's a no way out. So you can get in, but you can't move up. But generally, if we look at sort of earning power across the educational spectrum, in other words, looking at those who have a secondary school education or less versus those who have a university degree or graduate degree, we see that the gap is narrower at the lower levels and wider at the higher levels. So acquiring more education doesn't necessarily translate into you being able to compete better with a male counterpart. That doesn't enhance your prospects. It does enhance your earning power overall, but it won't enhance your prospects relative to a comparable male.
If you have a woman that's in a senior management position compared to a man in senior management, the man's getting paid more.
Generally, that's probably what's happening.
Women have always had difficulty getting into senior management positions, but it seems that if you're from a marginalized group, it's even more difficult to climb the ranks and to get better salaries.
You said earlier that the skills that women bring into the workplace, such as being more cooperative, such as having more of an emphasis on communication mm-hmm. or on consensus, are things that often disadvantage them. But if we add another layer into not fitting in workplace culture, say a woman is an immigrant, or a woman is from a visible minority, mm-hmm. or a woman dresses differently, do you have any ideas on how this might further disadvantage her? Or is that as tangible as gender discrimination?
Well, I think what happens is that employers bring certain stereotypes to the people that they hire. Mm-hmm. And those stereotypes are not only gendered, but they're also, for example, racialized. So certainly, I think to be, for example, a person of color, to be an immigrant, to belong to any of these categories, whether it's to be a woman, to be an immigrant, to be a person of color, is to be the category of difference. It's to belong to the category of constraint. It's to be othered. And employers are, I think, engaging in that othering. And when you are othered, the markers are generally negative. The connotations are generally bad. They're irrational and they're wrong, but they're negative and they're a strike against you. You're in two or three of these categories, whatever categories you belong to, whatever social categories you belong to, social groupings. Yeah, you face a double jeopardy. You face a triple jeopardy. Your prospects are even further diminished in terms of your ability to get in, your ability to get up, and what you get once you're there.
But if the workplace isn't a level playing field now, in 2006, when are we going to achieve equality?
If we continue at the rate we're going in terms of labor force equality, or maybe I should say inequality between men and women, if we continue at the rate that we're currently at in terms of realizing change, it will be 500 years before we have equality, according to the United Nations. And I'm not sure we have 500 years to wait here.
Another topic we talked about is who gets hurt when women are paid less.
Well, if we look at dual-income families, today what we're seeing is that nearly 70% of families are dual-income, which is a radical change from if we go back to the mid-60s, in which the number was somewhere around 30%. We're living in a very different reality, and that money that women earn matters for families. So when women are discriminated against in the labor market, that has not only individual implications, it has broader implications for families and for society as a whole. If we look at families that are not dual earner families, if we look at families in which you have a single parent, you have a lone parent with children, again, there's a kind of feminization of poverty going on here. With, as of 2003, of these lone parent families who were low income after taxes, you had 38.4% of them female-headed and 12.6% male-headed. So again, women are really kind of more disenfranchised than their male counterparts.
Even though it's women who are being paid less salaries, it's really a societal problem. It's their children that are being hurt.
It's their children that are being hurt. it's their spouses that are being hurt. It means that they bring less resources into the household, mm-hmm. which affects all. And this is a problem that should then concern us all. Again, I think there's a tendency for us to want to individualize the problem or, a kind of blaming the victim mentality. Well, it's because of this. It's because women bear children. It's because they aren't as productive. It's because of this. It's because of that. But those responsibilities fall upon all of us. They don't fall upon women. They're not women's responsibilities. They're all of our responsibilities. And until we're willing to recognize that, we're going to have a situation like this. But it really is incumbent upon all of us to work for a more gender equitable situation.
Seeing a feminization of poverty in Canada, studies like Triple Jeopardy show us that if you're from a racialized group and you're Muslim, then that's two more strikes against you. Like Dawood Hamdani pointed out earlier, even when Muslim women were compared to faiths that had similar demographics of visible minorities, Muslim women still fared worse. And Nuzhat Jaffrey told us that when she conducted focus groups with Muslim women across the country earlier this year, she found out the women who wear the hijab are facing even bigger barriers. And the problem is not as simple as looking different. Sometimes, an aspect of your religious practice and the inability of an employer to accept it can create conflict in the workplace. One woman who wears hijab will be telling us about how a potential employer's insulting treatment prevented her from getting an internship position in a clinic that she considered important for her career.
During school, I had a stage where I was going to be placed in a CLSC that I really wanted to be placed in because this could affect my future job. If I got into that CLSC, eventually I could find a job there because it's very difficult to enter that network. And on my first day meeting the supervisor for my stage, as soon as I arrived, he saw me as a mahajaba and his face turned. I could see that he was clearly unhappy to see a veiled woman. And then he extended his hand for me to shake it, and I said, "I'm sorry, I don't shake hands." And usually when I do that, I kind of put my hand on my chest, and I say, "I'm sorry, I don't shake hands," and I kind of nod my head as if I'm not bowing, but kind of like, you know, I'm making a gesture of connecting with you, but not physically. And I do it with a smile. So I say, "I'm sorry, I don't shake hands," you know, with a smile. And his face turned again. Like, he was like, "Ugh," you know, really upset. So then he kind of pushed the door open, and he's like, "Follow me." And he was really dry with me. The whole interview, he was very, very dry. He would say very little, and he would make almost no eye contact. And any question I would ask, he would give me very bad information, like, "Oh, in this stage, you know you're not going to have your own office. The workload here is really, really heavy. You should consider other placements. I'm going to be seeing the other students and see who I pick," which is a lie because he doesn't get other students. It's only one student at a time. So, you know, he was lying to me about that. And then in the middle of the conversation, he was talking about other organizations that he worked with, and he mentioned the SOC, the South Asian Women's Association. And I said, "Yeah, I know them." And then at that point in time, he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, but they're liberated." I was like, "Oh, my." I just remember being shocked by it. I must have said something. What did I say? He said, "No, but they're liberated." No, I don't think I even said anything to that. And I was trying to read him, trying to figure out why was he telling me all these negative things about this placement. It didn't click that he didn't want me there. I just was really kind of taken by surprise. But when he said that, I was really, really upset. And the one thing that came to my mind is, I am not taking this stage. Like, no matter what, I am not taking this stage. And I had to go back to my coordinator and tell her, "Look, this guy, he was very rude to me. He was very unprofessional. He said these things. And I didn't even tell her he reacted to my hijab and my handshaking, because I don't think she would necessarily relate to that. But everything else he said, I told her, and she was shocked. She said, "Oh, I don't think I should be sending any other student to him." So she took proper action and took him off her list. Yeah. But it's a very, very unsettling experience when you're sitting alone in a room, the person that's interviewing you, and you know that your whole year that's going to be your stage is in his hands, and this is how he treats you.
that discrimination is not necessarily the biggest barrier for women wearing the hijab. A large part of careers are built on social networking and your relationships with your colleagues. What happens when the social dynamics of your office exclude someone from your religious background? Shelby Daigle, who spoke at the beginning of the documentary, will be sharing her thoughts with us again.
The reality is that to get a job, yeah, it's important to get a university diploma or university like degree or a college diploma, but you also need to network, right? And to be able to do those networks, usually it's a lot easier for you to do that if you already come from a background of people who are well off and do that kind of work. If you do not come from that background, it's going to be very hard for you to do that. And because that's true not only for like many people in the Muslim community, but many visible minority people in general that don't come from communities that hold economic power, it's going to be very hard for them in general to get to where they need to be. Just because, you know, they're not in the same social circles that they need to be, where it's going to be easier for people who are already born in those social circles. They'll just get up there. I think the issue of networking in terms of promotion for a woman who wears hijab is a really serious, serious problem. But again, it probably depends on her line of work. Like, if she goes into a line of work that is more dominated by women, it might be less of a problem, simply because women, you know, women can socialize and network over lunch. You know, they don't necessarily need to go out and drink. So, you know, if she's in a more social work setting, if she's in, you know, nursing, like, those sort of things, like, she'll, you know, it won't be so bad for her. But if she's in, say, engineering or the tech industry, it's going to be a problem. Even for Muslim men is a problem, because I can remember a friend of mine, you know, who wore hijab, like her husband wanted her to come to this party, and like they went, but like, yeah, everyone was drinking alcohol, and he wanted to be part of the culture of his office because it was going to help him be promoted, and it was also good, and he wanted his wife to be there because that also was sort of just important in terms of like his image as a reliable person or something, I don't know. But difficult for them. But again, it was like sort of that idea of a double life. Like, you're of course not going to drink yourself, and you're just going to have to smile when you watch other people get really drunk. And then you just come back home and be like, oh, these, you know, crazy white people, like, why are they so crazy? But like, you have to sort of grin and bear it. But again, it could limit like how close you get. Because I find a lot of Muslim men will go out to the bar with their coworkers. They might not drink, but they can just sit there and be there. But like, if you're a woman wearing hijab, you cannot go into a bar. Like, I'm sorry, yeah, there's no law stopping you from going in there, but you're not going to be okay if you go in there. Like, you're not going to be okay in the bar because people are going to probably freak out on you, and then you're also not going to be okay if like your neighbor or your mom finds out you went there. Like, it's just not okay. You just cannot do that. So it is probably difficult in terms of gaining like that kind of camaraderie or trust with your coworkers. But again, it just depends on the kind of environment. Like, in the government, I find, you know, because I have a lot of friends who work in government, and it's not so much of an issue there, I find, like, because the government has its own discrimination. Like, so it's, and it's a lot more complex than just, you know, around visible minorities. Like, they'll just discriminate against a lot of different people for a lot of different reasons. But there's ways to socialize there, like around lunch or like around, you know, different conferences and that sort of thing, where, you know, you can get promoted as a Muslim woman. But you just have to sort of, unfortunately, you just have to choose your work environment. So I think it's probably really difficult for Muslim women in science. Like, and a lot of Muslim women do go into science. Like, they do get math degrees. They do get engineering degrees. They do get, like, degrees in different, you know, high-tech, because, as I was saying before, like, for a lot of people in the Muslim community, they're not coming from a lot of money, and so you want to go into a career that's going to get you a lot of money because, you know, you understand the value of money and you need it. So I think for Muslim women in those industries, it's probably really hard.
Laws for employment equity can help women who wear the hijab get into jobs, but does it mean that once they are in these jobs that they'll be able to climb the corporate ladder? Especially because the culture most corporations promotes conformity. While some employers might have open minds and the best of intentions, your performance is determined not only by how well you complete tasks, but also by your relationships with your colleagues. The biggest barriers facing women who wear the hijab are not necessarily an active or premeditated exclusion. Instead, it becomes a matter of normativity. Who fits in and who doesn't?
And one of the keys often, you know, my friends in those industries will use is just that, like, okay, I'm going to go somewhere where I know they need to meet a quota. Like, they know they need to have a certain amount of visible minorities and they need a certain amount of women. So I'm going to be a visible minority and a woman. So I'll get promoted based on that. And to a certain extent, it's true. Like, they can sort of, you know, play that line. But, I mean, it's really hard, right? Because they can't say, get really close to the top. Like, they can get as far as you can get for a company that wants to meet a certain quota on being diverse. But you can't, because you can't play hardball with the big boys, because you can't go out drinking with them, or you can't pull an all-nighter with them, because if you don't get home by a certain time, your parents are going to kill you, and you don't want to hang out with a bunch of men alone at midnight anyways. So again, I think it'd probably be the same problems any woman would have, but it's just added different personal limitations. Like, you just might not feel comfortable around men who are drunk, or men who might be hitting on you, because particularly in, like, I think the tech industry, like, they're just so desperate to find women anyways, or, like, you know, just, or because, you know, you'll have certain pressures from home, either from a husband or from a family, that's just like, there's no way you're staying out that late, there's no way you're going to this, because it's just not gonna happen, it's not safe for you. So yeah, again, but it just depends on the kind of workplace a woman goes into.
That was Shelby Daigle reflecting on the dominant culture of the workplace and how it can create barriers for women wearing the hijab. We're almost at the end of the hour, but we're nowhere near the end of understanding the particular challenges encountered by Muslim women in the workplace. There is nothing unique about a specific group of people in the labor force facing prejudice and intolerance, but there is something unique about the complexity of the discrimination against women who wear the hijab. They're not just experiencing discrimination against their race or gender or religious practice or how they dress, but for all of those factors combined, and is having tangible effects on how much money they earn and the quality of life they can have in Canada, which is why we're seeing poverty increasing among certain groups of women. Even though Canada has been having budget surplus after budget surplus, Muslim women and women who wear the hijab are getting left behind. I asked Nuzhat Jaffrey from the Canadian Council of Muslim Women if she thought that this put a very heavy burden on women who wear the hijab.
Sometimes you may have to seek legal advice. And you have to be prepared to challenge the system. And Muslim women have to be empowered to do that. They have to learn how to take that on and fight their battles. Because if you want to avoid being ghettoized and being isolated, then a lot of the onus is also on you as an individual, not just on the greater community. Open by the feet, daddy.
There's no doubt that if we want to see change, someone has to be willing to take a stand and challenge the status quo. Women wearing the hijab have to find strategies to demand their rights, either individually or collectively, as a matter of economic survival. However, if they are struggling to get or keep their jobs, I was curious to know how they would have the time or energy left over to campaign for their rights or to go through the lengthy bureaucratic process of filing complaints about harassment. I asked Nuzhat Jaffrey if she thought that putting the onus on women who wear the hijab to challenge the system is a huge burden to put on them, considering that they're already facing so much hardship at work.
But you see, I think again, we're starting to talk like victims, and we really have to avoid that. Because we're not the first, you know, in the country to experience discrimination. Other people have. In fact, there are lots of communities that are trailblazers in Canada. The Sikhs went before us. The Orthodox Jews were before us. The issue of discrimination in the workplace is not new and limited to Muslim women or Muslim women wearing hijab. African Canadians, Chinese Canadians, Ukrainian Canadians have all experienced a level of discrimination. Italians, you name it, any immigrant community has. The other issue, you know, I mean, yes, that's why we call our study Triple Jeopardy, the issue of gender, race, and then, you know, religion. And religion, if you're visibly, you know, different or look different, that is, in your dress, then you're, you know, I guess quadruple jeopardy. So I think the issue is that it has happened before. We are not alone, and we have to build coalitions and alliances with other organizations that continue to fight discrimination in the workplace. So that's one way. So there's collective action, we know, with other equality-seeking communities and organizations, and then there is action at the individual level. So when you talk about the burden on the Muslim woman wearing the hijab, yes, it's difficult. Yes, it's daunting to actually take on a system. But there are laws in place for us and systems in place for us to take it on. And if you're a Muslim woman who is experiencing discrimination in the workplace, you should seek out others who work in this area. There is legal aid, there is support in the workplace, and, you know, you have to start trusting the system. You have to say that, yes, there are policies in place, there are laws in place, and they're for me and for everybody else. And if you find that the system isn't working for you, go to your politicians. You know, it's very important for us not to feel victimized and feel alone and isolated, and say that, you know, we are bearing the burden of all of this by ourselves. It's very important to find partnerships and alliances with others, and within the community, within your family. I think that's what others do as well. And we can't keep on telling ourselves, well, we're different. Yes, we are, but guess what? Others felt the same way before us.
No social change has happened without someone seeking out their allies and resources. But what about the women who are struggling the most? Let's say that you're an immigrant woman who wears a hijab, you live in subsidized housing, you're a single mother, and you're scraping by from day to day. Who is going to make sure that your children are fed and that your rent is paid while you're challenging the system?
I think you have to ask a very basic question. Of any woman or anyone in that situation, your first priority is, you know, feeding and taking care of your family and having a roof over your head. So obviously you're going to go and look for that. And, you know, women in those situations have, again, depending on the resources of that individual woman, you know, have many, many supports available to them in the community. And I'm not saying I'm not naive, and I'm not saying that they will not experience greater anxiety and discomfort because of the fact that, you know, their means and their supports are limited because they are new, they are refugees, they are... Sometimes Muslim women become destitute, you know, within their own communities because of a bad marriage or awful personal situations. So, again, they are not alone. And observation that I have made, is, you know, in working in the community is that places like counseling services or employment services, they are extremely open and willing to work with women in similar situations. They seek out help from community agencies or from the broader community, Muslim community, to help them, help the women. So I think it's really important for us to know that, you know, Canadian society and Canadian social service agencies are much better equipped to, in fact, offer services to Muslim women than I would say most societies in the world. You know, you go anywhere, you're going to find that there's a lot of discrimination against women, women who are different, women who are destitute and desperate. There's a lot of discrimination against women. In this society, I believe that Canadian society, particularly social service agencies, are much more willing and open to help women in those situations. And that's what the women have to do. They have to access those resources. Yeah. The challenge for a Muslim woman who hasn't had opportunities for interaction, you know, in the broader society would be greater. But that is the reality of those women, and they need to be supported in other ways, you know, through their families, through the broader Muslim community. But I don't think that we can assume that those women are going to be ignored or will suffer on an ongoing basis. We need to be able to advise them and provide support to them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important, again, for us to be very careful and not perpetuate a picture of Muslim women as victims and incapable of agency, because that is not the case.
That was Nuzhat Jaffrey from the Canadian Council of Muslim Women, suggesting strategies for women who wear the hijab to fight discrimination in the workplace. Though it is important not to perpetuate the idea that Muslim women are victims or are helpless, this still does not change the fact that some women wearing the hijab face much larger barriers than others, especially if they are poor, have recently immigrated to Canada, don't speak English or French, and are so preoccupied with taking care of their children that they don't have the time to find out about or access their resources. No one would say that it's impossible for women who wear the hijab to make it to the top. And women in general have always known that you have to work twice as hard to get half as much. But if you're a woman of color or a Muslim woman, well, you probably have to work 4 times as hard. And if you're a Muslim woman who wears a hijab, then you have an even bigger challenge cut out for you. Despite the overwhelming amount of anecdotal evidence, the topic of discrimination against women who wear the hijab in the labor force is vastly under research. One conclusion, however, can be made about the status quo in the workplace. The more you vary from the norm in Canada, which is male, white, financially stable, Anglo or Francophone, straight, and so on, the better you have to be and the harder you have to work to prove that you are just as good. The extent of how much harder women who wear the hijab have to work remains to be definitively proven, Meanwhile, we are in the ironic situation of Canada becoming wealthier as a country while one of the most educated segments of its population is being pushed deeper and deeper into poverty. We've reached the end of The Layers of Discrimination. This has been a production for CKUT 90.3 by Emin El-Masri and Tamriz Anam. We would like to thank all the individuals we interviewed and who informed our research. I would like to especially thank Kate Waller from the Canadian Research Institute for the Advancement of Women, Halima Mutbar from the Council on American Islamic Relations in Canada, and Leslie Shung from the Canadian Labour Congress, as well as all the women who wear hijab who shared their stories with us. And last but not least, our gratitude towards Professor Alia El-Saji of McGill University for her generous support and for the support of the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. We'd like to dedicate this documentary to all the women who are trying to find solutions. Thank you for listening.